This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Trouble on Paradise, Book 3.5 of Expeditionary Force, written by Craig Allenson, performed by R.C. Bray. Chapter 1. 3 days after Skippy used Maser Cannon projectors to destroy the Kristang battle group at Paradise. All Z-phones in a bag. Staff Sergeant Sir Max pointed to the sack he held with one hand. A trickle of sweat ran down his forehead and into his left eye. The salt stung his eye. He wiped it away with the back of his free hand, silently cursing the steaming jungle heat of Lemuria, the southern continent where the Ruhar had dumped almost all humans on Paradise. "Dumped us here," he thought bitterly, "to get us out of the way, out of sight and out of mind for the Ruhar civilian population. Stuck in Lemuria without transportation, without weapons, where primitive humans could not cause problems for the Ruhar government. Far enough away so humans could not threaten the native Ruhar. The Ruhar government had been right about that, when Ruhar starships completely dominated the skies. And then a Kristang battle group arrived in orbit and everything had changed. Those humans who had remained loyal to the Kristang had renewed hope of the Ruhar being forced to leave Paradise. That happy situation ended 3 days ago, when giant Maser cannons no one had known about had blasted most of the Kristang ships apart and thrown the strategic situation on the planet into chaos. A chaos that Staff Sergeant Sir Max and his fellow Keepers of the Faith hoped to exploit to assure the Ruhar did not regain control over the planet humans called Paradise.
"I turned it off, Sergeant."
Eric Koblenz waved his Z-phone, reluctant to part with his only means of communications beyond shouting range.
"In the bag," Sir Max insisted. "And that wasn't a suggestion, soldier, it was an order. You think pressing the off button really kills the power to a Z-phone?"
Eric cast a guilty look at his Z-phone.
"The light turns off. This is why you shouldn't do the thinking around here, Koblenz."
Sir Max tilted his head as if he were speaking to a young and particularly stupid child.
"This is alien tech. We don't understand anything about it. You've got a Kristang phone using a Ruhar network. Even if the damned hamsters haven't figured out how to load tracking software into these things, I can guarantee the lizards were listening to everything we said and wherever we went, whether we turned it off or not. Put it in the bag."
"I hadn't thought of that," Koblenz admitted and handed the phone to the sergeant. Sir Max took the Z-phone, checked that it was powered down, and dropped it in the bag.
"When's the last time you charged it?"
Koblenz looked surprised by the question.
"Never. The lowest it ever showed was an 86% charge."
"And you've had it since Camp Alpha?"
Sir Max didn't wait for an answer.
"These things pick up energy from motion, from the sun, from your body's electrical field, even from the magnetic field of the planet. We don't ever need to plug them in to keep them charged. That tells me that we humans don't understand this tech at all. We're leaving these here. You heard the orders."
He meant word passed down from the informal leadership of the Keeper movement.
"From now on, communications are voice only, person to person, nothing electronic and nothing in writing. Our enemy," he meant the Ruhar, "can hack any signal we transmit and crack any encryption we use."
"Great. That's all of them."
Sir Max took the last Z-phone, cinched the bag shut, and dropped it under a bush. The Z-phones were waterproof. He didn't need to worry about them.
"Now we get out of these uniforms. Strip off everything except shorts, boots, and socks."
He took off his own top. Eric Koblenz didn't like the idea of walking through the jungle of Lemuria almost naked.
"We're going into this op in our underwear."
"No, Private Koblenz."
Sir Max pointed to a trio of duffel bags on the floor.
"There's good, honest homemade pants and shirts in those duffel bags. We'll be wearing those. These uniforms are too likely to have tracers attached to them, so they're staying behind."
A soldier named Markey fingered the collar of his uniform top suspiciously.
"Sewn into the collars?" he guessed.
Sergeant Sir Max shook his head.
"No, that's what we would have to do. With the tech available to hamsters, they could weave nanofibers directly into the fabric anywhere."
"Well, they can track us. Could they be listening to us now?"
Markey hurried to get his top and pants off, flinging them across the hut.
UNEF Intel doesn't think the hamsters are doing that, and that is one thing Keeper Leadership trusts UNEF Intel to tell the truth about.
Sir Max shook his head.
Since we all usually carry Z-phones everywhere we go, the hamsters have no need of any other way to listen to us. They might also be tracing us with our socks or underwear.
He gave a rueful grin.
Or our boots. That's a risk we'll have to take.
I'm happy to get out of the UNEF gear, Markey grimaced.
Some of them, Markey included, had all already removed the UNEF patches from their uniforms when UNEF Command on Paradise traitorously considered declaring allegiance to the Ruhar. The Keeper Movement got a significant boost 3 days before when mysterious maser cannons blasted the Kristang battlegroup and chased the remaining ships away from Paradise. Rumors were flying around that humans, UNEF, were involved somehow in a treacherous sneak attack on humanity's allies. That had been the final straw for many people who were on the fence about joining the Keeper Movement, or were lukewarm about their commitment to the Keeper cause. For humans to take up arms against the species who protected Earth from the Ruhar was too much for the Keepers not to take action. Direct action. It was time, Keeper leaders had declared in clandestine meetings, to act. An attack on UNEF headquarters? That idea had been discarded because humans killing humans was not likely to impress the Kristang, and because not even the most fanatical Keeper wanted to kill other humans. The best option for Keeper action would be to hit the Ruhar directly. But since humans were isolated on the southern continent of Lemuria, hitting the Ruhar was impractical. Keeper leadership was at a loss for ideas, until UNEF received notice from the Ruhar that there were several potential projector sites on Lemuria. The Ruhar would be investigating and working to reactivate projectors on Lemuria. What they wanted UNEF to do was to stay the hell out of the way. Rumor had it that neither the Ruhar nor the Kristang controlled the projector's network, which UNEF HQ was trying to make sense of. According to another rumor, there were dozens of other projector sites around the planet that neither the Ruhar nor Kristang had found yet. Both sides were frantically deep scanning the surface to find the hidden projectors. Immediately following the Ruhar message, the Kristang had sent a message to UNEF Command, stating that they also would be flying over Lemuria. The Kristang would be trying to find and reactivate projectors for their own use, and trying to seize control of or destroy projectors that were under Ruhar control. The Kristang had angrily demanded that their human UNEF allies resist the Ruhar and assist Kristang efforts to take control of projectors. UNEF Command responded to both Ruhar and Kristang that humans were effectively neutrals in the current fight. An easy decision since unarmed humans couldn't do much anyway. It was an easy decision for the Keepers also. They did not have to find a way to travel all the way to the northern continent to hit a Ruhar target. The Ruhar were coming to them in Lemuria. According to the Kristang, the Ruhar had identified a hidden projector site less than 40 miles from a UNEF village on the western edge of UNEF territory. The Ruhar had flown a team there to excavate the site and bring the projector back online, and that was expected to take at least several days. During that time, the Ruhar team on the surface would be vulnerable. This was the big opportunity the Keepers had been looking for. A chance to hit the Ruhar directly and do something useful to help their Kristang allies. If Keepers could attack the projector site, they could delay the Ruhar effort to reactivate the weapon. Possibly even force the Ruhar to retreat long enough for the Kristang to arrive and take over. Attacking the Ruhar at the closest projector site would be the most useful action humans could perform on Paradise, since the time Sergeant Bishop and his team shot down a pair of Ruhar whale dropships. No way were the Keepers going to miss what was likely to be a one-time-only opportunity. Staff Sergeant Sir Max had been contacted by the Keepers' leadership. The message was written in code on paper and hand-delivered by courier. Sir Max burned the paper immediately after reading it. Then he gathered a team of volunteers. Their mission, and the mission of four other similar teams, was not to attack the Ruhar yet. They couldn't attack effectively, as they had no weapons other than spears, bows and arrows, and shovels with sharpened blades. Sir Max's mission was simple. A raid on a UNEF security patrol to acquire weapons. Once the Keepers had weapons, real weapons like M4 rifles, some of the Keepers would create chaos and distractions while the main team hit the Ruhar projector site. When the team was dressed in their new clothes that had been handmade from old tents and whatever other fabric was available, Sir Max led them out of the back of the hut and straight into the jungle. There was a cache less than half a mile inside the jungle with such weapons as were available, and backpacks that were distressingly light on food. They had packs of dehydrated soup made from vegetables and fruit, some dried fruit, and bread that had been baked hard as a cracker. In the heat and humidity of the jungle, Sir Max expected even the tough bread to start going bad quickly. No matter. They had enough food for the planned length of their mission, plus 2 days, on lean rations. They could manage.
"You heard?" Captain Chisholm asked as he burst through the door of the hut. He removed his camouflage patrol cap and shook it in the doorway to get rid of the water from the jungle rainstorm. Chisholm was careful with the cap. It was the only one he had left. No more supplies were coming from Earth. UNFHQ on Paradise was not issuing any gear to keepers like him.
"Yes, sir," Sergeant Robinson acknowledged, holding up his Z-phone. "The message was directed at us."
He meant the keeper village.
"By now the whole planet will have heard. Are we going, Captain?"
"I am. This will be volunteers only, Sergeant. The Kristang asked for 50 men. Men only."
He grimaced at the need to comply with their allies' prohibition against women in combat. Against women in pretty much any military role. There weren't many women in the village. As a percentage of inhabitants, the keeper villages had even less women than the general UNEF population. But excluding women made it more difficult for Chisholm to round up enough volunteers.
"My guess is 50 of us is the max they can cram aboard whatever transport they're sending."
After the massive air battle now called the Great Paradise Furball several days ago, neither side had enough aircraft to establish air superiority and barely even enough to support ground troops.
"Sir,"
Robinson glanced away, then met the captain's eyes.
"Do you believe the Kristang? That they really need us to support an assault on a Ruhar projector site?"
Chisholm's eyes narrowed. Robinson was one of his most trusted, steady men. If Robinson was questioning their lizard-like allies, many others in the village were also likely having second thoughts. Declaring continued loyalty to the Kristang and disgust with UNEF was easy to say. Actually going into combat against the Ruhar was the real test of whether humans on Paradise would be keepers of the faith.
"We've been lied to so many times, I'm questioning everything I've been told, sir," Robinson stated flatly. "We don't have weapons, we've not been trained to fight alongside the Kristang, and we'll be attacking a position the Ruhar will have had time to prepare for a static defense. The Kristang will probably want to avoid damaging this projector, so we won't be allowed to use artillery, which we don't have anyway."
"The Kristang will provide weapons," Chisholm said hopefully.
The message had not included that detail. The message overall had been short in details, being devoted mostly to taunting and insulting humans as being wholly unworthy of being considered allies by the glorious Kristang. This, in a message that ordered the Keeper Village to provide 50 volunteers. Captain Chisholm was determined to remain loyal to his original pledge to the Kristang. That didn't mean he was not aware their communication skill could use some improvement.
"The Kristang never trained us to fight alongside them because they are super warriors. They never thought we would be of any use to them in combat. Humans are too short, too slow, too weak to keep up with the Kristang troops. They gave us the evac mission here because all we had to deal with was hamster civilians, and we almost screwed that up anyway."
Robinson nodded, but he didn't look happy.
"I'll go if you go, sir. Scraping together 50 volunteers quickly might be a tall order. Most of these people haven't done any combat training in a long time."
"None of us have," Chisholm agreed. "We've been too busy trying to feed ourselves."
He almost added, "No thanks to the Kristang."
"Talk to people, Sergeant. I'm going to meet with as many people as I can. Major Gomez wants as many volunteers as possible. It would be great if the entire village is waiting when the Kristang transport arrives. That's in," he checked his Z-phone, "less than 2 hours.
When the Kristang transport arrived, it was trailing smoke from one engine and set down heavily in the middle of a cornfield, skidding and plowing up several meters of precious crops. If people had known the Kristang would treat a critical human food source so carelessly, there may have been even less than 47 volunteers waiting. The transport was distressingly small. Captain Chisholm did not see how 50 humans could possibly fit inside, nor how such an overloaded transport could manage to take off. Major Gomez, who would be staying behind because a tree had fallen and broken one of his legs, gave Captain Chisholm a questioning look. Then Gomez regained his composure and drew himself upright. His people were already uncertain about the situation. He could not show his own fears. The rear ramp of the transport swung down, and two Kristang in body armor panels stepped out, waving the waiting humans forward. The front rank hesitated until Major Gomez saluted them and pointed to the transport. Then, with a shout that was less loud and enthusiastic than Gomez hoped for, the front rank trotted forward and up the ramp. Gomez then turned and saluted Captain Chisholm.
"Captain, good luck to you."
"I will return with my shield or on it," Chisholm said with grim determination. Gomez suppressed a frown at Chisholm's melodramatics.
"Just remember, Captain, your mission isn't to win the battle for the Kristang. It is to demonstrate to our allies that humans are steadfast and reliable in combat. No one expects your men to take on the Ruhar by yourselves."
"Yes, sir." Chisholm's expression reflected his excitement. He started to run forward and turned to say something, but whatever sentiment he intended to convey was drowned out by the booming voice of a Kristang, amplified by the transport's external speakers.
"Human, we ordered 50 of your men to be provided to us. We count 47.
The translated voice still conveyed outrage.
"We are," Gomez looked around, mortified.
He had ordered all other people not going with the Kristang to stay out of sight. But human nature being what it was, curiosity had gotten the better of many people. Gomez himself, with his right leg in a splint and him leaning on crutches, was clearly not capable of combat. The people peeking around huts or lingering at the edge of the field were not doing humanity any favors. What could he say? That some among the keepers of the faith did not want to go into battle with their patrons?
"You have our finest. Give us 3 more or we will take them from you," the Kristang's voice demanded.
The two Kristang at the bottom of the ramp stopped urging humans aboard and unslung their rifles. Gomez spoke as loudly as he could, hoping his people would respond. Since they had broken with UNEV, the keepers had kept to a military hierarchy, but Gomez knew he really had only as much authority as his people wanted to give him. Ordering 3 people to their likely deaths was probably not within his power.
"Keepers of the faith, we need 3 true warriors to step up and prove that humans do not cower from the prospect of battle. Prove to the aliens who rescued our home planet from invasion. 3 people."
There was movement at the edge of the field, people shuffling their feet and talking to each other, but no one had yet stepped forward. Gomez feared the two Kristang soldiers would charge across the field, grab 3 of his people, and start shooting the others. He opened his mouth to openly plead for volunteers. But just then, 3 men who had been huddled and talking animatedly with each other stepped forward and began slowly jogging across the field, jogging as if at any moment they would surrender to their fears and stop.
"Warriors of Earth," Gomez shouted, "we salute you."
The major's salute was picked up by the people ringing the field, and if the 3 had any doubts, they squashed them and continued forward until they reached the bottom of the transport's ramp. There, the 2 hulking Kristang prodded them forward with the muzzle of their rifles. The Kristang shuffled forward until they disappeared into the transport. The ramp closed, and the transport took off unevenly, dragging itself forward, then flying low, churning up and destroying crops as it flew. Black smoke poured from one engine before the engine sound changed and the smoke became thin and white. The transport gained speed rapidly and was lost from sight beyond the jungle trees. Gomez shuddered. 50 people, all good people. People who had sacrificed their futures in order to protect the billions of humans on Earth. He did not expect to ever see them again.
"We wait here." Sir Max held up a hand to halt the column the next afternoon.
"What's up, Sergeant?" Koblenz asked quietly.
"We have to cross a river, so we'll be marching along this road."
He pointed ahead to a bright line across their path, a place where there was a gap in the dense interlocking canopy of trees overhead. The jungle concealed the marchers from satellites, although everyone expected Ruhar sensor technology would not be degraded by something as simple as tree cover. The purpose of staying off the roads was to avoid UNEF troops who might be using the roads.
The road has a bridge across the river. We wait here until an hour before dark, then we cross the bridge. To save you from asking me more stupid questions, Koblenz, we are waiting because there is a regular UNEF patrol that drives along this road every afternoon. After those Humvees pass by, we get on the road and cross the bridge.
We're not going to ambush that patrol? Markey asked.
No, Sir Max shook his head. Too hard to target for us. They'll be inside their Humvees. We don't have anything, he pointed to the collection of crude weapons carried by the team, that can penetrate that glass the hamsters use.
Sir Max knew that in the steamy afternoon heat of the jungle, the patrol would have their Humvee windows rolled up and the air conditioning on. The glass of Humvee windows was a tough, clear composite material that an arrow or spear, even a large rock, would bounce right off. On Camp Alpha, Sir Max had seen a demonstration that a Humvee window could stop a 9mm round at close range. He remembered being amazed that a 9mm round left no more mark on the window than if a large bug had hit the window at highway speed. The standard 5.66mm NATO round from an M4 rifle didn't fare much better against the Ruhar glass. It took an explosive-tipped Cristang round to punch through the composite, and the Cristang advised more than one hit was needed to be sure to make a hole in the glass.
We'll let those boys ride right by us.
After their forward lookout reported that three UNEF Humvee patrol vehicles had rolled by, the keeper team tentatively stepped out onto the road. Sergeant Sir Max had assured them there were no UNEF soldiers nearby, so they could talk normally. But most people were walking without speaking. Early evening in the jungle of Lemuria reminded Eric Koblenz of a summer evening back home. Towering clouds were tinged orange and golden by the rays of the setting sun. Insects were already buzzing or chirping on both sides of the road. The typically gusty midday wind had died down, and the air was absolutely still, without even a breath of breeze. The thunderstorms that rolled across the jungle every afternoon like clockwork had been brief that day, so that the dirt road had quickly dried out, and boots kicked up puffs of dust as they marched. It was peaceful, and by unspoken agreement, people didn't want to break the quiet that wrapped around them like a comforting blanket. Or they were all lost in thought, and maybe many of them were thinking of home, a planet they would probably never see again.
"You're quiet?" Markey nudged Koblenz and almost whispered. "What's going on with you? You're usually a freaking motor mouth."
Eric Koblenz looked guiltily toward Staff Sergeant Sir Max.
"Does this sit right with you?"
"What part of it?" Markey answered quietly. "Being on another planet, or the planet being controlled by the enemy, or that the Ruhar may not be our enemy?"
"Shit," Koblenz breathed out a defeated sigh. "All of that. This is way too freaking complicated. I'm a soldier. I have a rifle. Point me toward a target and I'll do my duty. Out here I'm being asked to decide who the enemy is."
"We can't tell the enemy from the good guys?"
Markey shrugged. "Hell, the U.S. Army has been fighting that way since Vietnam. Ain't nothing new. Iraq, Afghanistan, Nigeria, all the Hajis look the same."
"Yeah, I guess. Here, the Hajis are us."
"How you figure that?" "We're not marching to attack the hamsters. We're on our way to hit humans. UNEF or not, they're humans. Humans could get killed by other humans. How fucked up is that?"
Markey nodded.
"Effed up for certain, man. I'm doing what I think is the right thing, but..."
Eric grimaced and looked up at a cloud. Surprisingly, it had rained only briefly that day, and the air was suffocatingly hot.
"I came all the way out here to do my duty, and if UNEF HQ ever reports back to Earth, they'll say I went Elvis on them," he said sadly, using slang for a soldier absent without leave.
"Hey," Markey gripped Koblenz's shoulder reassuringly, "we didn't go over the hill on UNEF.
They abandoned their mission on us. Koblenz looked sadly down at his dusty boots.
We're in a jungle, on an alien planet, and I must be homesick because this reminds me a lot of home. You know, walking down a dirt road on a summer afternoon kicking up dust, coming back from a swimming hole or fishing or whatever. Walking home. He blinked to clear tears from his eyes. Damn.
He wiped his eyes with the back of a hand.
This dust is getting to me.
Yeah, the dust,
Markey agreed, suddenly thinking of his own home in Kentucky. Thinking of when he was a boy, walking along the dirt road behind his parents' house. Walking with a group of friends, coming back from a creek where there was a deep pool of water perfect for cooling off on a hot summer day.
Where's home for you?
West Virginia, Koblenz answered. My folks have a place up in a holler. That's a valley. I'm from eastern Kentucky. I know what a holler is.
Markey had to blink away his own tears.
West Virginia, huh?
Almost heaven, Koblenz said with a quickly fading grin.
I've been there. My mother's parents are from Beckley.
Koblenz nodded.
I miss it. And now I think I'm never going to see it again.
Markey watched Eric Koblenz hang his head miserably, staring at his boots as they marched. Markey patted the soldier on the back and began to sing softly.
Almost heaven, West Virginia. Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life is old there.
Koblenz joined him, neither of them having any talent for singing and not caring.
Older than the trees, younger than the mountains, blowing like the breeze.
Six other soldiers around them picked up the familiar chorus, singing louder.
Country roads, take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, mountain mama, take me home, country roads.
Then the whole column sang, even Sergeant Sir Max.
All my memories gathered round her. Miner's lady, strangers to blue water. Dark and dusty, painted on the sky, misty taste of moonshine, teardrops in my eye. Country roads take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, mountain mama. Take me home, country roads.
When they finished the last chorus, even Sir Max had tears in his eyes.
Ah, damn it, now you guys have gotten me going.
Where's home for you, Sergeant? Markey asked.
Alabama, Sir Max said wistfully.
And, of course, that started the entire group singing Sweet Home Alabama, making Sergeant Sir Max have to join in. Captain Chisholm sat rigid with his back to a rock, trying to control his ragged breathing. There was a soldier to his right and one to his left, also gasping for air as quietly as possible. All three of them gripped their Chinese rifles so tightly their knuckles were white. Chisholm knew that was bad practice. He also couldn't order his own fingers to ease their grip at the moment. Chisholm and two others. As far as he knew, they were the only survivors of the 50 humans and 6 Kristang who launched the assault on the Ruhar-held projector site. The display in the Kristang goggles he wore, connected to his Z-phone, showed less than 16 minutes had passed since the dropship landed and 54 warriors raced out to charge the Ruhar position. Because the dropship had been forced to fly low and land behind a hill to avoid Ruhar anti-aircraft missiles, the landing zone had been 1.5 kilometers from the Ruhar forward positions. To make contact with the enemy, Chisholm and the other humans had to run over 1 kilometer uphill through dense jungle in the steaming heat. In what Chisholm took as a bad omen, the sky had opened as a brief storm pounded the area with rain almost as soon as his feet stepped off the aircraft's ramp. The assault plan, as explained by the Kristang during the rough flight as they were all crammed in the back of the aircraft, was simple. Captain Chisholm and the 49 other humans would charge straight at the Ruhar, making as much noise and causing as much havoc and confusion as possible. 3 of the Kristang, wearing awe-inspiring powered armor suits, would swing around to the right, hoping to outflank the Ruhar defenders and gain direct access to the shaft being dug down to the projector. The 2 Kristang pilots, no doubt knowing they were on a certain suicide mission, brought their aircraft in fast and low from the left, strafing the Ruhar positions, but being careful not to hit the projector site. The 6th Kristang, who had the misfortune of not having a powered armor suit, went up the center with the humans. Officially, the Kristang with the humans was there to provide leadership and guidance on tactics. In reality, he was there to encourage the untrusted humans to attack with true warrior spirit. Chisholm quickly saw that meant their Kristang guide shooting in the back anyone who hesitated even slightly. The first victim to fall was a soldier who stopped running forward because of a large tree down across his path. After first trying to climb over the log and slipping on the mossy growth that covered the rotting trunk, the soldier fell back to the ground and backed up 2 steps to go around the worst of the tangled branches. That momentary retreat of 2 steps earned the human a single shot to the back of his head. Chisholm had been startled to hear the distinct report of a Kristang rifle, and turned just in time to see the now headless soldier's body slumping forward. Captain Chisholm was not the only human to have second thoughts about their forced alliance with the Kristang right then. And he was not the only one to consider turning his own rifle on the vicious Kristang. Chisholm saw several rifle muzzles begin to swing toward their Kristang leader.
"Keepers! Forward!"
Chisholm found himself shouting to his own surprise, years of army training taking over and saving his life for a few more minutes. The Kristang was not wearing a powered armor suit, but he was a genetically enhanced super warrior who had a better than even chance to shoot first at anyone who pointed a rifle in his direction. And he was wearing some sort of composite armor panels covering his torso, head, arms, and thighs. Chisholm's brain had taken in all those facts as he decided without thinking to continue the charge rather than shooting in rage at their leader. That particular Kristang was satisfyingly dead as Chisholm huddled behind the rock, working up the oxygen and courage to stand up and run forward. Chisholm had seen the Kristang die, sliced apart and burned by masers. The Ruhar preferred direct energy weapons to kinetic rounds, although their rifles also could fire explosive-tipped darts that were propelled by an undermounted railgun. To defeat the masers and particle beams of their usual enemy, Kristang armor was designed to flake and ablate away when struck by a beam, protecting the user. The armor could not hold up against being struck by multiple beams, nor could it stop beams from penetrating gaps in the armor. The Kristang had gone down when a maser cooked his shoulder through a gap in the armor. As his head tilted back, another maser had deflected off his chest armor, and searing energy seeped through the seam between the chest armor and the neck of his helmet. Seeing the Kristang's skull being boiled from inside and then exploding against the faceplate of his helmet had been both horrifying and satisfying at the same time for Chisholm. Then Chisholm had no more time for reflection as the jungle was crisscrossed by masers, and he needed all his attention to stay alive. The attack had been a disaster from the start, although Chisholm had been surprised by the poor performance and lack of coordination by the Ruhar defenders. As soon as the ground team left the aircraft and began running through the jungle, the Kristang launched handfuls of miniature flying drones to counter the Ruhar drones that were already in the air. The fierce drone battle lasted less than a minute as Chisholm and his fellow soldiers ran through the jungle, fearfully glancing at the sky. When the drones finished tangling across the sky, neither side had a single functional drone in the air. The 2 Kristang pilots were the first to die from enemy action. Their aircraft had barely cleared a hilltop to begin strafing the Ruhar when they were hit simultaneously by 4 of the 6 missiles launched by the Ruhar. The burning wreckage of the aircraft cartwheeled through the jungle, knocking down trees and sending splinters flying in every direction. Not a single splinter of wood reached the Ruhar positions. The sacrifice of the aircraft had been for nothing. The air power portion of the assault was an utter failure, except that once the Ruhar no longer faced a threat from above, they seemed unsure of what to do. During the flight in, Kristang had told Chisholm and his fellow keeper soldiers that the Ruhar were overly reliant on air power and seldom practiced ground-only fighting tactics. This fact was the chief hope of the 6 Kristang to take on a Ruhar-prepared defense with only the support of 50 primitive humans.
"Ready?"
Chisholm asked the soldiers on either side of him, and they both nodded in quick, jerky motions reflecting their fear. Chisholm checked the magazine of his Chinese Army QBZ-95 rifle. Somewhere, the Kristang had gotten access to Chinese weapons, and that is what they provided to Chisholm and his team. Few of the Keepers had ever handled such a weapon, and Chisholm had found the bullpup-style rifle, with its curved magazine behind the trigger, to be awkward. He kept bashing the magazine into his hip, and it was difficult to fire from a prone position. At least the Kristang had provided plenty of explosive-tipped ammo of the funky 5.8mm size used by the Chinese rifle. Chisholm ejected the half-empty magazine and inserted a full one, figuring he would not have enough time remaining in his life to swap magazines in combat. He took 3 deep, calming breaths and prepared to order a final assault. The purpose of the attack by 3 humans would not be to take the Ruhar position. They had no hope of accomplishing that. What they could accomplish would be to demonstrate to Kristang, across their star-spanning empire, that human allies could and would fight to the death. Perhaps the assault never had a chance, Chisholm thought as he steeled himself to stand. The 3 Kristang in powered armor had all been killed without succeeding in outflanking the Ruhar defensive positions around the excavation site. Rather than the wave of human cannon fodder providing cover for the armored Kristang, the opposite had happened. Apparently the Ruhar commander quickly decided 3 armored Kristang warriors were a greater threat than a group of lowly humans. That decision, and the poorly coordinated, hesitant response by the Ruhar, were the reason Chisholm and 2 others were still alive. Why they had gotten within 50 meters of the Ruhar defensive line, gotten close enough that Chisholm had seen the excavation site through the jungle, before raking fire that killed 12 others forced him to momentarily take cover behind the rock. Cruel as their Kristang leader had been in shooting or stomping to death anyone who failed to run absolutely flat out through the jungle, Chisholm saw the wisdom in the tactic of simply rushing forward as fast as possible. Their only hope for success, for survival, was to catch the Ruhar off guard, to hit them and be upon their defensive line before the hamsters could adjust to the surprising threat. That fact of speed being preferable to cover was still true as Chisholm huddled behind the rock. In the few seconds they had taken cover there, the Ruhar could have outflanked them. Chisholm had seen Ruhar soldiers run, and they could seriously move, even burdened by weapons and their own body armor panels.
"We go on 3. 3, 2, go!"
Chisholm shouted, springing to his feet and running. He collided shoulders with the soldier to his left, making both of them stumble for a step as the soldier to their right was cut down by a pair of maser beams. Chisholm had barely time to trip over a tree root before a rocket exploded at the feet of the other soldier, throwing the man's body into Chisholm. Captain Chisholm fell, losing grip on his rifle. Then his helmet slammed into a tree trunk. Chapter 2. 4 days after Skippy used maser cannon projectors to destroy the Kristang battle group at Paradise. General Marcellus, acting Chief Intelligence Officer for UNFHQ, remained soberly silent after the conclusion of the briefing from the Ruhar officer. The briefing, given by an angrily resentful Ruhar officer, had been ordered by Deputy Administrator Logelia. The Ruhar military had already been embarrassed and angry about the content of the briefing. To air their dirty laundry in front of 2 humans was almost too much to bear. Seated beside Marcellus, U.S. Marine Corps General Bailey was also silent, mulling over in his mind what they had learned during the previous 37 minutes. What they had learned was that the Ruhar were not perfect, fantastically advanced though their genetically engineered bodies and their technology were. Their super soldiers were not invincible. Based on their performance in the battle during which a well-armed Ruhar security team had nearly been overrun by 6 Kristang and 50 humans, the Ruhar were not even competent ground troops. Marcellus thought that if the battle had been a war game and he had commanded the defense as an army captain, he would have received a scathing chewing out by his superiors afterward and been sent for remedial training in infantry warfare tactics.
"This is very embarrassing," the deputy administrator admitted, breaking the depressing silence. Compared to primitive humans, Ruhar soldiers were supposed to be superior warriors with advanced weapons and enhanced biology through genetic engineering. "My military advisors tell me our troops and our training are not coping well with ground warfare. We may have become too reliant on air power. Our forces have been slow to adapt to combat that is restricted to the ground." She held her hands palms up. "You must understand, Warfare, where neither side has orbital bombardment capability or air power, is highly unusual in this conflict. The Kristang have a slight advantage in this type of combat. Because of their constant fighting between clans, they practice ground combat frequently. Fighting between clans often happens in crowded urban areas where neither side can risk air power or heavy weapons. Marcellus looked at Bailey, who tilted his head.
Administrator Logelia, Marcellus offered, we may be able to help you. Our forces are very well trained in ground combat.
Bart, Bailey interrupted, can we talk privately?
Excuse us for a moment, please, Marcellus asked Logelia before he and Bailey walked out into the corridor.
Keeping his voice low, though aware the Ruhar could listen if they really wanted to, Bailey shook his head.
I thought the official UNEF position is that we are neutral in this battle.
That ship sailed over the horizon when a bunch of dumb fuck keepers joined the Kristang and killed Ruhar, Marcellus explained. If we don't demonstrate that the Ruhar can trust UNEF, at least trust UNEF HQ, we're going to be in big goddamn trouble.
And if we do throw ourselves into the fight on the side of the Ruhar and the Kristang take this planet back?
Nick, we are thoroughly fucked anyway if the lizards take paradise, Marcellus declared. Helping the Ruhar now won't make the lizards hate us any more than they already do, but it might make a big difference in how the Ruhar treat UNEF once the fighting is over. All I'm talking about for now is a few human observers riding along on a Ruhar raid, see how the Ruhar fight. Maybe we can give them advice. Hell, fighting desperate ground battles with inadequate resources is the U.S. Marine Corps' specialty, isn't it?
Hoorah, Bailey muttered. All right. If I can persuade HQ to allow us to ride along, I'm in. Damn, I'd love to see Ruhar troops in action. All I've seen of Ruhar combat tactics so far is sims provided by the Kristang. Now that we know the lizards are lying MFers, I don't know if anything they told us is true.
The next night, Staff Sergeant Sir Max and his team approached a small village, small even by the standards of UNEF on Paradise. The village had been planned to be larger, but the nearby river flooded out the first planting of crops, and it had been decided moving the residents was easier than building a flood control barrier. Now, only four people stubbornly clung to the huts they had constructed, tending the fields farthest from the river. The UNEF security patrol stopped in that village only because it was conveniently located at the point where they had to turn around at nightfall, and because the empty huts provided a convenient place to sleep without having to set up tents. Sergeant Sir Max had been directed to the village because the UNEF security team was known to stop there overnight. With the village being on the edge of UNEF territory, the patrol team was casual about security at night, according to a rumor heard by a keeper. Sir Max was counting on that rumor being true, and he was counting on human nature. At the end of a long, boring day on patrol, and in the middle of nowhere, the temptation would be for the security team to not make a lot of effort to lock their weapons away. They would likely bring some weapons into the huts with them, but keep the other weapons in their Humvees. To get into a locked Humvee, Staff Sergeant Sir Max had homemade explosives, supposedly enough to blow a hole in a window so someone could reach in and unlock a door. Supposedly, the explosive was also not powerful enough to blow up the Humvee and its power cells. Sir Max had to trust the chemist's word on that. To grab the weapons out of a Humvee quickly after blowing a window, his team needed to be close to the Humvee when the explosive detonated. They would not have a large margin for error, and no backup.
After we get the door open, we grab whatever weapons we can find. Priority is heavy weapons. I don't have to explain that to you. If this goes south, we split up and meet at the rendezvous point sundown tomorrow, Sir Max reminded his team.
If the operation were to fail, Sir Max thought his team might be hunted from the air by Ruhar aircraft equipped with sensors that could see right through the jungle canopy. According to the Kristang, the massive air battle that was already being called the Great Paradise Furball had destroyed most of the Ruhar's air power, and neither side had starships in orbit at the moment. Sir Max and the entire Keeper leadership
We're counting on the Ruhar not being willing to assign their precious remaining air assets to tracking a few troublesome humans in the jungles of Lemuria.
You all know what to do? Sir Max asked, and everyone nodded agreement. They had gone over the plan 24 times, so each member of the team knew their assignment.
Excellent. Remember, we don't want any casualties unless absolutely necessary. Anyone fires a shot or an arrow without my order, they'll be left behind. Got that?
The team advanced through the almost pitch-black jungle, with Sir Max cursing their complete lack of night vision gear. The Ruhar had taken away all the combat-capable toys provided to UNEF by the Kristang, and even had collected the crude night vision gear UNEF had brought from Earth. The various types of Z-phone all had a night vision capability, but of course they couldn't use Z-phones for fear of being tracked. The team advanced single file as stealthily as they could manage while stumbling through dense jungle undergrowth in almost complete darkness. Their only guide in the night was a single light outside a hut in the village ahead. When Sir Max judged they were less than 50 meters from the clearing, he had his team spread out.
Joy, Martinez, you take point.
Nobody move.
A woman's voice rang out from the jungle to their left, followed by a single round fired into the air for emphasis. Bright lights clicked on around them, blinding Sir Max's team. Shading his eyes with one hand, Staff Sergeant Sir Max counted 6 lights, possibly mounted under M4 rifles.
Do not move from where you are, the unseen voice ordered. Drop your weapons now. Do it, now.
Do what she says, Sir Max ordered.
We're just going to give up, Markey protested.
We're going to live to fight another day, you idiot, Sir Max snapped as he dropped his bow and arrow. We're surrounded by at least a half dozen people armed with M4s at least. They may have this area seeded with claymores.
That's a good guess, the voice acknowledged.
It's what I would do, Sir Max said with grudging respect. Everyone do what the woman says. Drop your weapons and put your hands above your heads. This fight is over for us. For now.
Other than collecting their backpacks, spears, bows and arrows, knives, and other crude weapons, the UNEF security team didn't do anything to restrain Sir Max's team. They didn't have to, for without the food in their backpacks, they were totally dependent on UNEF for survival. After they were herded into the village, the keeper team could see they had been ambushed by a British UNEF security team, led by a female lieutenant.
If you don't mind compromising operational security, how did you know we were coming here? Staff Sergeant Sir Max asked hopefully.
Don't mind at all, the lieutenant answered with a grin, her teeth shining brightly in the artificial light. We didn't know you were coming here until you passed by the only other places you might target.
You tracked us, Sir Max said with disgust.
The whole way. She lifted a boot. Tracking sensors in our boots, your boots. The hamsters probably have trackers and other sensors in our clothes, but they know we can't go far in this jungle without boots.
Shit, Sir Max groaned.
He had wanted to make footwear, even had a design sketched for wood soles and canvas uppers, but Keeper leadership told him there was no time. They needed to seize the brief window of opportunity while the Ruhar did not have control of the sky.
We had no chance then.
No, she shook her head. You didn't have any chance at all. Thank you, Staff Sergeant. You did provide my team with entertainment and a training exercise. Things have been rather dull around here. This will make you feel worse, so I'm going to enjoy telling you. Your whole mission was a waste of time and energy. Shortly after you left, the lizards landed aircraft in several keeper villages and flew away with volunteers. The lizards are not only short on air power, they are thin on manpower. They took on volunteers, that's what they called them, to help secure projector sites the lizards have been trying to reactivate and to attack projector sites held by the Ruhar. That's what the lizard said, anyway. Command reports your fool keeper brothers are being given light weapons and thrown into hopeless ground assaults against projector sites controlled by the Ruhar. The one assault they conducted so far was a slaughter, almost all the keepers dead or wounded. And the Ruhar still hold the position.
According to the liars at UNEF command, Markey said and spat on the ground.
The British woman gave a disdainful shrug.
You don't need to trust the word of UNEF Command. Think for yourself. How would a small group of humans fare against a well-armed Ruhar security team? The intel report from UNEF Command had privately concluded the Keeper assault had been much more successful than expected by the Ruhar. If the Keepers merely had another dozen soldiers, they might have overrun the projector site and temporarily seized control of it. If they had even temporary control, they might have been able to damage or even destroy the projector, or hold it long enough for the Kristang to reactivate the projector and prevent Ruhar starships from approaching the planet. The problem for the Ruhar, UNEF Command concluded, was they were used to relying on air power, and their skills at ground combat had been allowed to atrophy. By contrast, UNEF troops were well accustomed to improvising tactics with limited resources. Humans, especially out among the stars, were experts at dealing with limited resources. The Ruhar had already very grudgingly admitted they might be able to learn something from the primitive species from Earth. "What's going to happen to us?" Sir Max asked, with a warning look at Markey to keep his mouth shut. "My orders are to transport you to a holding facility."
"A prison," Koblenz said angrily. "You are the traitors. You should be in prison."
The lieutenant ignored his remark.
"What happens to you there, I don't know, and I don't care. If it were up to me, I would drive you sleepers to the end of the road." She pointed past the village to the edge of UNEF territory. "And leave you in the jungle. Instead, my orders are to see that you are fed and receive medical care as needed. I am a soldier. I follow orders from the chain of command. Think about that while you have nothing else to do at the holding facility, and think about the fact that the lizards threw your volunteers into a slaughter with no hope of accomplishing anything."
"That goes for all of us," Sir Max said quietly.
"Staff Sergeant?" she asked.
"All of us," he pointed to her security team. "All humans, all of UNEF, everyone who left Earth. None of us ever had a chance to accomplish anything useful out here. You have a rifle." He pointed to the British Army L-85 rifle the lieutenant carried. "The hamsters," he pointed to the sky, "have starships. None of us can do shit out here."
When General Marcellus suggested the Ruhar follow UNEF observers to accompany a Ruhar ground combat force, he intended to send for a hand-picked UNEF team from Lemuria. Instead, because Administrator Logelia enthusiastically embraced the idea immediately, Marcellus and Bailey found themselves hustled aboard a Ruhar combat transport within the hour.
"Be careful what you ask for,"
Bailey muttered under his breath to Marcellus, as a resentful group of Ruhar soldiers herded the two humans up the ramp of their transport, an aircraft that had many hurriedly patched holes in its wings and hull. The Ruhar military intel group had learned the Kristang were sending at least two transports full of warriors to raid and capture a recently discovered projector site. During the intense ground battle, the two humans were stuck inside their transport, safely tucked behind a hill. The location was only theoretically safe, because the Kristang had managed to launch a pair of anti-aircraft missiles that popped up over the hill and scanned the area, searching for targets. Both missiles were intercepted by the transport's defensive maser turrets, but warhead debris pinged off the hull like hail. The Ruhar pilots gave apologetic looks toward the humans, who both merely shrugged. Marcellus, and even more so Bailey, chafed at not being outside with the Ruhar assault force. However, with the Ruhar providing virtual reality goggles, even Bailey had to admit he was actually better able to observe the overall battle from inside the transport. The VR goggles, connected to sensors embedded in the helmets and weapons of Ruhar soldiers, allowed the two humans a god's-eye view of the Ruhar side of the assault. They could select to see what an individual Ruhar was seeing, or zoom up and watch the battle unfolding from above, as if the dense forest tree canopy were not there. What Bailey saw and heard did not impress him. It distressed him.
"Well," General Bailey said with a grunt as he and Marcellus walked the battlefield after the last shot had been fired, "this sure was a full-blown clusterfuck of epic proportions. If one of my platoon commanders conducted an assault like this..." He moved to nudge the inert body of a Kristang in a powered armor suit.
"Don't!" General Marcellus warned as he grabbed Bailey's arm, pulling the Marine back. Those powered armor suits are like a shark's jaws. They can hurt you even when they're dead. When the Ruhar determine a particular suit is really inactive, they paint it with a yellow circle.
He pointed to a yellow-painted suit 10 meters away.
Bailey tilted his head.
Bart, that is something I would find useful in an intel briefing. His tone implied that he rarely found intelligence briefings to be useful.
Nick, I only learned about it a minute ago. A hamster had to stop me from getting myself killed, he said with an embarrassed grin. I'm sure that reinforced the hamster's thinking that we lowly humans don't belong on any battlefield with them.
Are you kidding me? Bailey snorted without humor.
You saw what I saw. The Ruhar should have kicked the lizard's scaly asses here easily. Instead, they got thrown back 3 times before they broke through the Kristang perimeter.
He shook his head disgustedly.
And their casualty rate was 36%. That's shameful. If the Kristang had more than 20 minutes to prepare defenses here, the hamsters might have been sent scurrying back to their base with their furry little tails between their legs.
Marcellus almost remarked that Ruhar did not actually have tails. Bailey had a point. The Ruhar assault had almost failed. The two overloaded Ruhar transports, with Marcellus and Bailey riding in cockpit jump seats as unwanted observers, had landed near the recently discovered projector site only 40 minutes after 2 Kristang aircraft landed. The Kristang had quickly overrun and killed the lightly armed Ruhar survey team, and had been working to set up a defensive perimeter when the Ruhar attacked. The battle had seesawed back and forth for almost an hour, with both sides acquitting themselves poorly, before the superior numbers of the Ruhar wore down the Kristang and were able to get 5 soldiers behind the Kristang lines. After that, the battle became a frantic, swirling, disorganized gunfight of individual soldiers fighting on their own in the thick forest. Marcellus thought he knew the answer. He asked anyway.
You think we can help our furry allies?
Help?
Bart, supply my people with the fancy weapons and body armor the Ruhar have and give us back our Z-phones and enhanced vision goggles, and we could have taken the Kristang position here in 1 assault, without genetic enhancements. And with a hell of a lot less casualties. Hell, the Ruhar have totally forgotten basic principles of infantry warfare. They're too reliant on air power. Their fire teams didn't support each other during the advance. They know nothing about overlapping fields of fire. They got bogged down behind cover way too long. We teach full-spectrum dominance battle tactics, but we also train our people what to do if our airdales aren't able to provide support. The Kristang didn't do much better in my assessment. They had 3 powered armor suits, he refrained from kicking the nearest example with a boot, while our Ruhar buddies only had 1. The lizards should have used the advantage of those 3 supersuits to sortie out and outflank us. They could have caused all kinds of havoc. Those MFers can run like lightning in those suits, even in a forest. Instead, they wasted those suits on static defense. That idea was a loser from the get-go.
What?
While Bailey was talking, Marcellus tried to silently get the Marine's attention, finally resorting to a slashing motion across his throat. Bailey turned around to see a Ruhar officer standing behind him. The Ruhar's name tag read something that might have sounded like tall to a human. The Ruhar must have heard most of Bailey's harsh analysis of the Ruhar assault, for the officer's expression was an angry glare.
Hey,
Bailey nodded. He knew Marcellus would prefer he offer an apology to the Ruhar, but Bailey's thinking was that he had nothing to lose.
You heard what I have to say? What is your opinion of this goddamn mess?
The Ruhar set his jaw and did not speak. Did not speak verbally. His eyes and body language spoke volumes.
You and I are soldiers.
Bailey pointed to his uniform, ignoring that technically he was a Marine.
We can leave the touchy-feely bullshit to civilians and talk about what really happened here, or we can be nice and diplomatic and waste our time while the lizards are kicking your asses all over this planet.
Your planet. The Ruhar's intense glare only intensified. Marcellus set his mouth in a pained grin.
What General Bailey means is...
What I mean is, Bailey interrupted, that we humans have experience in down-and-dirty ground fighting. We have to. Because by your standards, we don't have any technology worth mentioning.
Anything above 10 meters off the ground, we're hopeless. He held his hands palms up. With the toe of a boot, he scraped a furrow in the rich forest soil. But here, on the ground, we know how to fight. He stared the Ruhar officer in the eyes. Fight without orbital fire support and without air power. You're an infantry officer? The Ruhar waited for the translation and nodded curtly.